Jason Breen, co-chair of Arnold Golden Gregory's post-acute care team. I'd like to welcome you to our second episode of AGG's podcast series, AGG Talks Home Health and Hospice. Our podcast series features AGG attorneys and guests discussing business and legal issues for our friends in the home health and hospice industries. If you'd like to access our first episode in which we discuss the home health and hospice deal environments, you can find the audio on AGG's website, social media, and where podcasts are generally available. Today, I'm happy to be joined by Alex Foster, a partner in AGG's healthcare group and member of the post-acute care and private equity teams, as well as Charmaine Meck, a healthcare associate who is also a member of the post-acute care team. Today, our episode will focus on home health and hospice diligence, where Alex and Charmaine will provide a high-level overview of the healthcare regulatory diligence performed in acquisitions, as well as some nuances buyers and sellers should be aware of in the home health and hospice space. So with that, we'll dig right in. I want to begin with Alex, if you can introduce yourself and then provide some background on your involvement in the home health and hospice space, and in particular, your involvement on diligence of such projects.
Sure. Thanks, Jason, and happy to join you both for today's podcast. So I work frequently with home health and hospice providers, and that work is primarily on the transactional and regulatory side. I counsel providers on day-to-day operational issues, for example, specific patient issues that might pop up, and on broader operations issues, for example, developing admission agreements for providers across the country that are compliant with federal and state-specific requirements. I also work with providers involved in transactions, including asset and stock deals, on both the buy and sell side.
Thanks, Alex. Now, Charmaine, if you can introduce yourself, tell us how you participate in home health and hospice diligence.
Hi, yes. My name is Charmaine Meck. I am also on the transactional and regulatory side in the healthcare space, and much of my practice focuses on the fraud and abuse laws, so anti-kickback statute and the Stark Law, among others. And then I also do a lot of Medicare reimbursement appeals, and we've seen a lot in the home health and hospice space. So both of those expertise come into play from a diligence perspective.
Awesome. Now, Alex, I guess turning back to you, we'll do a little ping pong here. What areas of coverage do you see in home health and hospice diligence generally?
So I'm sure anyone listening can imagine that it's a fairly broad scope and involves a lot of detailed analysis. And I'd separate it into a few high-level categories. First, agency licensure, payer enrollment, and related change of ownership issues. You know, here, this is going to be just some threshold diligence. Do they have the right licenses? You know, this is speaking from buy side, the right enrollments, typically just Medicare and Medicaid, if not some other payers. And then what's required in order to change the ownership of those licenses and enrollments? And of course, that's going to vary widely by state and, you know, by structure of the transaction. We also look at payer contracts, including managed care contracts, which can be interesting because oftentimes, even if the work to transfer a license or an enrollment is not so burdensome, in order to transfer a contract, it can actually require a pretty significant time frame, depending on the payer. We also look at audits, investigations, and other government touches, compliance program status of the provider, OIG exclusion checks, HIPAA compliance, including any state level privacy laws, relationships with referral sources and marketing initiatives directed at referral sources, medical director and consulting physician agreements, beneficiary and patient issues, as well as COVID. And, you know, in COVID, we still see a good bit of activity on the diligence side, especially provider relief funding, since recently been a lot more activity on the audit side from the Health Resources and Services Administration for those who received provider relief funds, but also looking at COVID policies, things like that.
That's a lot of topics to cover. Charmaine, Alex mentioned buy-side diligence. I assume we also do sell-side diligence, and can you explain a little bit about what's involved with that?
Yes, absolutely. I'm seeing more and more sell-side diligence, sometimes called reverse due diligence. Now, depending on the type of transaction, the level of sell-side diligence will vary, but companies who are going to retain ownership and go into business with a partner, go into some sort of a merger arrangement rather than a complete acquisition, would like to know who they're going into business with as well. And so we do that sell-side diligence. It's typically more limited in scope, but we're seeing more and more of it.
Thanks, Charmaine. And since we're here specifically about home health and hospice, Alex, can you kind of walk us through some of the issues specific to that industry or those industries?
Sure. And two immediately come to mind, one on the home health side and one on the hospice side. On the home health first, so the 36-month rule, it's an interesting nuance that has to be very carefully considered in home health transactions. So the background, Medicare certified home health agencies must abide by the federal 36-month rule, which states that if there's a change of ownership of a home health agency by sale, which includes asset sales and certain stock transfers, within 36 months after the effective date of the home health agency's initial enrollment in Medicare, or within 36 months after the home health agency's most recent change in majority ownership, the provider agreement and Medicare billing privileges do not convey to the new owner, which invalidates the transfer of the Medicare provider number. Now, this is important because even if the transfer does occur and the parties don't realize until later, for example, if diligence is not done up front and there's been a violation of the 36-month rule, then it's effectively, you know, retroactive. There's no Medicare provider number. It's invalidated. And so any Medicare reimbursement sought for that time period would just sort of disappear. Diligencing the area is obviously very important, but also typically straightforward. We have some, you know, straightforward questions we ask about previous transactions when initial enrollment occurred that can just provide the assurance that we need that there's no 36-month rule issue. On the hospice side, hospice agencies are limited in the amount of reimbursement they can collect from Medicare in a single year, which is referred to as the hospice cap. So this is a specific nuance on the hospice side that we look at. Hospice cap is typically calculated by multiplying an annual per patient cap amount by the number of patients served by the hospice. However, the actual calculation can be complex and often uncertain. Importantly, for transactions and diligence purposes, any Medicare reimbursement that is paid over the annual cap must be refunded. And in a transaction, buyers will need to determine the potential cap liability, and the buyer and seller should address who will be responsible for any potential post-closing refund to the government.
Yes, those cap issues can really come back to bite people and hyper-technical. I know we've dealt with that on behalf of clients before. And interestingly, on the 36-month rule, I think the industry on the hospice side is now contemplating that that could come to hospice as part of some reforms that we're seeing out of recent proposals by the association. So Charmaine, turning to you, I know you do a lot of your diligence and regulatory work focuses on anti-kickback and Stark issues. Can you describe in more detail what that means on a diligence deal?
Yeah, like all diligence, the scope is going to depend on the nature of the deal and the parties involved. But because in our experience, most home health agencies and hospice agencies do accept federal reimbursement, meaning they participate in the Medicare and or Medicaid programs, we really need to think about the fraud and abuse law compliance in a meaningful way. So from a Stark law perspective, Stark law requires a physician relationship and has certain key terms that trigger its compliance, one of which is designated health services. Now, that is defined to include home health services, but not hospice. So sometimes it may not be as much of a concern depending on physician relationships and whether this is a hospice provider. So what we typically are focusing on is going to be the federal anti-kickback statute and any state kickback laws. And they're typically the primary concern that we're focusing in on when we look into a party's referral relationships, bonus arrangements. In addition, we're going to want to look at your marketing practices, both to providers for referral relationships and also to patients. We want to take a look into any patient inducements and make sure that all those arrangements and practices are in line and in compliance with the federal fraud and abuse laws.
So we've been talking about diligence kind of in the weeds so far, but I want to step back and maybe Alex, if you could explain for those, the uninitiated, what's involved in diligence from a logistical perspective? You know, how does that process work with, you know, data rooms and the like? Can you walk us through that so that folks have an understanding logistically about what might be involved?
Absolutely. It's a good question. And I think the answer and how it's approached in diligence can really determine, you know, how streamlined and easy the process is for both buyer and seller. As everyone listening will be aware, detailed diligence can be a very heavy lift and can overwhelm buyers and sellers if the right approach isn't implemented from the get-go. And it can certainly feel overwhelming even with the right approach. But from a buy-side perspective, I like to start off the diligence process with a kickoff call with the seller. The purpose of the call is twofold. One is to run through high-level questions that can help us cross off certain areas of diligence. For example, and this is pretty rare, but if there are no government payers, we can cross through a whole lot of our diligence questions, including a lot of areas such as anti-kickback, or at least limit the questions that we ask on that side. The other purpose is to set the tone in the relationship. So for example, if we're on the buy side, we want to assure the seller that we're rowing in the same direction. Our goals are the same. We want to make this as efficient as possible. Now, after that kickoff call, we have a good sense of the areas that we will need to perform detailed diligence in. And we usually will circulate a listing of all of our diligence questions if it hasn't been circulated before. Typically, a chart that lists out each specific item along with, you know, who's assigned to respond, notes from the seller, for example, if we're on buy side, so that they can either say not applicable or say, where is it located in the data room? Now, a data room is going to be a website, often box, where the parties will exchange the chart of questions and then upload responses. So the seller is going to, you know, say, okay, for question, for example, 3.1, request for all licenses, here's a folder that contains every license that we have. And, you know, I'm focusing on the chart because this sort of becomes the way that we dialogue with the seller or the buyer, depending on the side we're on, to keep all the parties aware and of what's been responded to and what remains outstanding. And in doing so, by staying coordinated, I think we get through the process more quickly. And for any of the typically minor items that we may not have received after, you know, some period of diligence, we may hop on another call to go through those and either find out, are we not receiving those because it's not applicable, or can we get a quick response that gives us the assurance that we need to wrap up diligence?
And Alex, as a follow-up, we've been talking about buy-side diligence, and Charmaine mentioned some sell-side diligence. What about diligence on yourself before going to market for quality of earnings and just kind of looking under the hood before you go out into the marketplace? Have you seen that become a trend, and is it effective for those who are thinking about going to market to maximize their value?
Yeah, good question. It has become very common across sizes of transactions or proposed sales. Typically, what they ask us to do is perform a regulatory analysis that will be very similar to the buy-side analysis, but, you know, sometimes keep it high level enough so that we're picking up really the major issues that could be uncovered, ideally none. But what we do is act in a way that's similar to if we were representing the buyer. And so materials are often uploaded to a data room from our client. We look through those and identify any issues for them that we think could be problematic and that a buyer would be concerned about. And, you know, the benefit there is that if it's possible to resolve those issues, once we find out about them, we can do that before they go to market or before a buyer learns of them. And so that when it's disclosed, we can say, you know, there was this issue, it's now been resolved, or at least if it's not resolvable at that time, we can make the buyer immediately aware, let them know it's being proactively dealt with, you know, just be upfront about any issues that are, you know, we're gonna have to disclose anyway. And, you know, I think it's very useful and I think it's a good idea. Typically, that engagement occurs about 1 to 2 months before you might enter into a letter of intent with a buyer. And I would recommend that for many potential sellers.
Yeah, it sounds like a good investment. I kind of view the letter of intent almost like an engagement to be married. So you're starting that process. And Charmaine, I guess, looking through the diligence, have you seen situations where the wedding had to be called off because of issues that were uncovered along the way?
Yeah, we've seen a real mix of issues cause problems in transactions. Some that come to mind are history of significant audit and overpayment activity without clear evidence of corrective action that can give rise to concerns about potential False Claims Act liability. And the False Claims Act is one of the fraud and abuse laws that we want to consider, and it's probably the most punitive with some of the largest possible penalties. So that concern can certainly raise a red flag and make people pause before proceeding. We've also seen improper referral relationships and patient marketing activities, particularly to government beneficiaries, cause problems. But I think one of the things, even beyond a big red flag issue that we have seen come up time and again and cause delays and even, you know, parties to walk away from a deal, is just a general practice of not being transparent and not being clear about, for example, reimbursement models or practice models or what materials you do or don't have. In our experience, it's not uncommon for smaller, more regional providers to not necessarily have extensive policies and procedures in place around certain areas, for example, fraud and abuse. Our policies is always better to be transparent. Just say we don't have X rather than trying to manufacture something for the sake of diligence or being overly evasive. That way, the seller can effectively evaluate the risk and they might just determine, okay, this is an area for improvement or education going forward rather than they're trying to hide something. Again, the structure of the deal, stock versus asset deal, among other things, can affect a buyer's risk tolerance. But it's really important to set the right tone. And I think being transparent about what you do and don't have, particularly with your own counsel, so they can best position how to package that up for the other side, really helps the whole process move more smoothly.
Yeah, no one likes surprises, and especially once you're midstream in diligence. We had one client, I remember, who had was near the closing date. And at that point, the seller disclosed that they had a nine-figure government investigation that had been ongoing. It was under seal, so it was not in the public domain, but that, no surprise, killed the deal. So no surprises. That's an extreme example, but even the smaller ones are not good. So transparency sounds like a great policy. Well, Alex, any closing remarks for our audience on home health and hospice diligence?
Sure. Thanks, Jason. Most importantly, with the right diligence team and approach, you can have a diligence process that is both as detailed and thorough as it needs to be, while also streamlining what can be a very stressful process. I would advise engaging an experienced legal team and a clinical diligence team if needed early in the process so everyone can work towards target dates, which I know is really the goal of all of this, is to get everything wrapped up, complete, all the parties, you know, happy with the diligence in a timely manner.
Thanks. And Charmaine, any closing remarks?
Yeah, so I just want to stress along the same vein as Alex that your legal team, particularly us here at AGG, are here to help. We want to work with you and get you to the end of the deal as quickly and painlessly as possible. If issues do come up, we are a resource here to help resolve those issues and get to the end result, whether that's a purchase or a sale.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank both Alex and Charmaine for sharing your expertise and experience with us today. It's been very informative. I know I've learned a lot already. We hope the discussion has shed some light for our audience on both the process and content involved in home health and hospice diligence. As always, if you have any questions or if you'd like to propose topics for future podcasts, please reach out to any of us directly at agg.com. And thank you again for joining us today.